The Manchester Food Cupboard has been at the forefront of the effort to help people who stop by their facility at the Manchester Town Hall access food items that might not be available to them any other way. They've been around since 1989, when a group of local residents formed the food cupboard to ward off hunger and make nutritious food available to those who needed it. The food cupboard typically distributes more than 12 tons of food each month to hundreds of local families. When the COVID pandemic first struck in 2020, demand for their services skyrocketed as businesses cut back operations and workers lost jobs. Now, more than 3 years later, the pandemic emergency has largely lifted and the economy has come roaring back. But demand for the food cupboard's services remains high as inflation has cut into the buying power of low to middle income residents. At the same time, most of the state and federal supports that were helping the most vulnerable have been sharply dialed back. Martha Carey, the program director at the Food Cupboard, gave her assessment of where things stood now. She was joined by Kate Koss, a volunteer with the Food Cupboard.
As of our latest tally for our year to date, we're up to 464 families who've accessed the Food Cupboard, and that's typically an amount that we would see in a whole year. Food price and availability has really put a lot of things out of reach for us. We are trying to fill the cupboard as best we can, but we're really kind of patching it together at this point, because things are just so expensive. In order to fill that gap, it is very expensive.
Yeah, food prices have gone up over 30%. And so it makes it difficult to purchase some of the staples that people need, that they depend on, you know, week to week.
So what do you think is driving the upsurge in the number of people who are coming to obtain some food from your, is it inflation? People in the area or what?
I think it's inflation, both of the cost of food and just the cost of housing in general. Life in general in our area seems to be getting more and more expensive, and you know, wages aren't matching that increase in cost of living, and so many programs that helped people get through the pandemic have ended. Extra food stamp money, the Everyone Eats program, like just thing after thing keep ending, and it just keeps making things tougher.
It's really been cumulative, I think, you know, like you say, with all the programs that are ending, and you know, there aren't, you know, donations aren't coming in, and you know, there's a lot of people to feed.
So what do you think should happen then to kind of offset these trends you're seeing? I mean, does the federal government or the state government need to make more money available to acquire some of the groceries, or what would be the best solution you could think of that would
an ideal world?
Yes. That would be lovely. I don't know that that would be the most readily available solution. I think what I think we need to do is just to again call on our local community to reach out to help each other. You know, just like during the COVID pandemic, people really stepped up to help their neighbors. And I think we're at another point where people really need to step up to help their neighbors. We have a growing population of people that are new to our country. We have some refugee families who have come here with nothing. We have people working in town at, you know, low wage jobs. Senior citizens who are on a fixed income while prices keep going up and up and up. I really, you know, it's a can of tuna here, a jar of peanut butter there. Just people in the local community being aware is what we hope will happen. That that the answer is right here.
And I think organizations, other institutions, perhaps churches, and doing food drives. You know, like the library, I think, does a food drive for us. But, you know, to get other, you know, other organizations involved to do food drives makes a huge difference.
But right now things are really tight. This is the hardest time of year. Always it's the hardest time of year, you know, because we're past the holidays, past the giving of the holidays, and not yet to the garden, the giving of the garden. So this is kind of that middle section that is where we struggle. People can bring food donations to the cupboard. We have a bin out in the hallway, or people can bring things by when we're here, which is usually all day Wednesday through Friday. People can drop things off at Shaw's or at the library, the Manchester Community Library, at any of the religious congregations in town, or people can send a donation old-fashioned way with a check to our P.O. Box, which is P.O. Box 864 in Manchester Center, 05255. Or they can also make a donation on our website, which is communityfoodcupboard.org. And we'd love for people to come in and see what we do, if anyone's interested in volunteering or just, you know, checking us out. We always welcome anyone who wants to come.
The Manchester Food Cupboard is looking at an expansion of its operation space, which should help them meet the needs of local residents. Right now, it's a pretty cramped area, but it's one that's going to expand, hopefully, by the end of this year.
Yeah, the idea is we're going to continue this roof line out. Our cooler is going to stay where our cooler is, and so it will just be a little past where the cooler starts, and the roof line will come down to about here where you're standing, so it'll just over double the space that we have now. So it's going to come all the way down here to not cover that door. That door will still be as it is. And then the idea is we're going to have a garage door so that when we get deliveries in, the delivery can just be wheeled inside instead of my recruiting volunteers to carry it in bit by bit in the rain and the snow. Yeah, so it's going to be a really big improvement for us. It's going to really make our operation a lot more efficient and helpful for people. My hope and prayer is that it will be here by the winter. We're going to need to do some fundraising to make that happen. We would love for people in town to pitch in to get us undercover by next winter. It's a really important service for the community.
For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. On May 11th of this year, 2023, the federal COVID-19 Public Health Emergency Declaration ended. The emergency declaration had been in place since early 2020 and gave the federal government flexibility to waive or modify certain requirements in a range of areas, including in Medicare and Medicaid. Mostly, we've moved on from the COVID pandemic, but is it now safe and appropriate to lift the emergency declaration? We asked two people who have been at the center of the pandemic from the start, Dr. Trey Dobson, the chief medical officer at the Southwestern Vermont Medical Center, and Becca Ballant, now Vermont's congressional representative in the U.S. Congress and formerly a state senator from Windham County and the state Senate leader from 2021 to 23. We started with Dr. Dobson, who gave us his assessment of what would be changing.
Well, we are seeing far fewer cases in two ways. One, we're seeing less cases, I guess I should say in three ways, Andrew. We're seeing fewer cases that require hospitalization, and that's, you know, generally what people are inquiring about when they ask me about cases. But we also, of course, have, you know, outpatient encounters, and those have dropped, as well as another measure we use is the number of staff, our own staff that have COVID that are out. And all three of those have declined. Now, we've been through this infectious disease public health emergency long enough to know that just because something goes down doesn't mean it won't come back up. And likely it will. You know, the cases will ebb and flow as predicted and as people talked about early in the pandemic, that at some point we would reach a time period where we get a steady state, and perhaps in the winter when people are closer together and have other diseases that cause coughing and spread of respiratory viruses, that we'll see increases. And that's what we expect.
So should people still be mindful of and get booster shots as they become available?
The shots that are available now, whether it's a booster or an initial dose for someone who's not been vaccinated, are the same. And that is this bivalent COVID-19 vaccine. In other words, it is directed at two different types of Omicron variants. That is continued to be in use. It's in use now. And it is recommended for everyone, not just 65 and above. It's recommended that everyone have received one of the doses of that vaccine, regardless of what you've had in the past. What has been made available for those 65 and above is a second dose. So let me just use myself as an example. I'm not 65. I did receive the bivalent booster. Now it's been about 8 months ago that I received it, right when it came out. And I'm not at this point, I'm not eligible, nor do I need another vaccine at this point. This fall, that will be a different story as we make the vaccine available typically as an annual type vaccine. And it also may be changed and modified somewhat to try to match the recent, as you mentioned, variants that are out there. Now, if I was 65 or if I had certain health conditions, even though I've already received one dose of the bivalent, it's been several months, it would be appropriate for me to receive a second dose of the bivalent. Someone might ask why. I just said that everyone's had vaccination and they've had a prior infection, whether they know it or not, they most likely have. Over 90% of people have been exposed to the virus. And the reason why is it offers additional protection against hospitalization. If you are not worried about hospitalization, it still offers additional protection about getting the virus in the first place. So yes, people can still get COVID-19, even though they've been vaccinated or they have seen the virus in the past, but the chances are less. So I don't know about you, but I don't want to miss work or miss a family vacation or miss my kid's sporting event with COVID-19. Even if it's not going to kill me, I just don't want to miss 3 or 4 days of my life if I can prevent it. If I own a business, I don't want my employees getting sick. I want them to be healthy. I want them to enjoy themselves when they're not at work, but I also want them to be available at work. And so the vaccine is a safe way to increase the odds of that occurring. It's the same thing with influenza.
So in general, then, do you think the ending of the public health emergency at this point is appropriate, or are you still concerned that maybe not out of the woods yet? This is a little premature.
Well, the ending of the public health emergency, as most people know it, it's definitely the right time. I'm certainly in agreement with that because the provisions that were put in place were necessary. And when they're no longer necessary, they become an obstacle, right? So let's just use masks for an example. You know, some people are now saying, well, we shouldn't have been wearing them in the first place. There's all these studies that say they don't really help. Well, they absolutely helped. They helped when we didn't have vaccine, when we had a virus that was killing so many people. They were necessary. But today, the masks are not as necessary. In certain situations, they should be worn. If you have the disease, you should be wearing a mask if you're out in public. And if you are very susceptible to the disease, you should be wearing a mask when you're around others in public areas. That hasn't changed. But the idea that a physician walking through a hospital or a teacher in a school must wear a mask or wearing a mask adds much value, that's no longer the case. And that's just the evolution of the virus. There are many provisions that came through the federal declaration that are no longer needed, but there are some that we hope would stay that aren't staying. Some of those are complicated and I'm not an expert on, but have to do with insurance and Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act and those who are eligible to apply that no longer are. Some of those things were really good for people and they were worth our federal dollars to support. And unfortunately, those are going away. There are small things that, when someone asks me what's changing in the hospital, to patients, not much. There are small things, though, that have gone away. For example, a hospital system could put in place provisions and facility changes without having to go through regulatory processes during the pandemic. And let me just give an example. I could put in a hospital room a makeshift negative pressure system so that I could help protect patients. Generally, that would need to undergo a lot of regulatory review, and it would need to undergo certain types of inspections. And those things were put to the side so that everyone could respond rapidly. Now, the ability to do that is gone, and that's okay. You know, we should have checks and balances whenever something new is being introduced.
We then turn to Congresswoman Ballant for her views on the ending of the emergency declaration.
My first question anyway would be, on balance, do you think the timing of this declaration is appropriate or premature? And are you concerned that some of these benefits that went along with the emergency declaration will negatively impact some folks?
Yes, it's a great series of questions. So I will start with, am I concerned that some of these supports are going away? Absolutely. What we have seen during the pandemic and you know, as the numbers of cases have waned and the numbers of deaths have waned, that hasn't meant that people who are facing serious consequences due to lack of food. I mean, that's continuing. And in fact, we were just meeting in caucus the other day here in DC in Democratic caucus, talking about how alarming it is right now that you have a significant number of folks within the Republican conference that are going after food benefits, going after SNAP benefits, maybe even holding up the farm bill because of that, at a time when we have so many families right now across the country that are food insecure. So absolutely concerned about it. I know that we were, it was not politically possible for us to continue in a state of emergency, given that we're not in the same place that we were years ago. But the need for food supports, the need for help with renter's assistance, the need for supports in Medicaid and Medicare, those continue. And this actually goes to the heart of why it's so challenging right now here in Washington is we are trying to hold the line on the debt ceiling and making sure we pay our bills, right? And at the same time, knowing, we're going to have to craft a budget this year. We, as Democrats, are not in the majority in the House anymore. We have the majority in the Senate. But those things that you're talking about that are, central to what Vermonters care about and have sent me to Washington to do, they're going to be hard fought this year. And I'm deeply concerned that given not just the state of food insecurity, but just the wealth gap right now in this country is much worse than it was even before the pandemic. And so these issues are going to continue. Another piece that I'm very concerned about is the mental health crisis. I don't know if you've been following all of the data that's been coming out in the last year. You've got 42% of students nationally, school-age kids, who report feeling persistently sad, lonely, disconnected. You've also got almost a quarter of whom have said that they had considered suicide in the last year. You've got a majority of the workforce that is struggling with loneliness and disconnection. So this is also related to the pandemic. It is not because of the pandemic. We saw increasing, an increase in anxiety and depression and persistent loneliness before the pandemic, but it has made it more acute. And I'm absolutely hearing that in every community and in every school that I visit right now. Kids are struggling, faculty, staff are struggling, and parents are too. And this is going to require additional resources. We can't turn away from this right now.
And then finally, I was just sort of a general broad question. What do you think were the big lessons learned from the pandemic? And if, God forbid, there were to be another similar episode in the next 4 or 5 years or whenever, what should we have learned from this past experience of the last 3 years or so that we could put to work to minimize the impact of a future pandemic better than what we did in 2020 and 2021?
I really appreciate this question because it actually goes to the heart of why I decided to run for office and to run to represent Vermont in Congress, which is my serious concerns about the democracy and its health. And if we had been in a better place as a democracy, if we still were living in communities where people felt like they could talk with their neighbors, even if they had different political views. I mean, you and I have talked about this before, you know, that exacerbated our problems in the pandemic. You had incredible distrust of government and of science, right? I think we didn't fully anticipate how deep those fractures were. Now we have been given a horrible wake-up call to the tune of, you know, a million deaths, many people struggling with long COVID. But there's also been a real price that we've paid at the local and state and federal level, just in terms of how do we disseminate information to a population, you know, somewhere, you know, between a third and a half of people are not trusting the sources, right? And I'm continuing to see that in the oversight committee that I serve on. There's still a lot of conspiracy theories out there. And so the way that I see of combating that in a real time way is for each of us to understand that we are, if we are not working to build those ties with our neighbors and within our communities, we're part of the problem, because we can't disseminate information quickly that will save lives. We cannot get support out to people, again, that will save lives and people's livelihood, if what you have is a deep distrust of any kind of government structure. And, you know, it is not lost on me that I serve on committees with people who supported the violent insurrection and who did not vote to certify the election and who still will not admit that President Biden is our lawful president. They are in the halls of Congress, they're in the House, they're in the Senate. And this is work that we're going to be doing for a generation, because the norms that we used to accept, peaceful transfer of power, that we don't support people that call on the vice president to be executed, you know, basic norms have been completely upended. And so it's a long-term project, and it's not just going to take people like me in Congress taking this on with my colleagues. It's going to take regular Americans saying, I don't want to live like this. And that is something that I've heard a lot in Vermont. I don't want to live like this. I don't want to be so fearful and so angry. And we've got work to do. We do. And what gives me hope is I'm serving in this freshman class with a whole lot of people who care deeply about protecting the democracy, just like I do. And I draw courage and inspiration from them. And I have also been able to make some friendships across the aisle, and going to continue to work on that. But it's challenging, because it is clear that the things that we used to accept as not political have become political. And that makes it challenging to come to any kind of agreement on anything. But I remain hopeful, because we have to do this work. We don't have a choice. So I might as well be happy fighting the battles.
Again, to highlight the big changes, vaccines will remain available. Access to COVID-19 vaccines will generally not be affected for now. The U.S. government is currently distributing free COVID-19 vaccines to all adults and children. But COVID-19 at-home tests may not be covered by insurance. Insurance providers will no longer be required to waive costs or provide free COVID-19 tests. Medication to prevent severe COVID-19, such as Paxlovid, will remain available for free while supplies last. After that, the price will be determined by the medication manufacturer and your health insurance coverage. You can check with your healthcare provider if you need early treatment to prevent severe COVID-19. And national reporting of COVID-19 may change. It will still allow the CDC, or Centers for Disease Control, local public health officials, and the members of the public to understand COVID-19 dynamics at the community level. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. The 6th Annual Southern Vermont Economy Summit was held on Tuesday, May 23rd, at the Hermitage Club at Haystack Mountain in Wilmington, Vermont, bringing together about 275 business leaders, town officials, and community and nonprofit organization members to hear presentations and take part in breakout sessions around a variety of topics, ranging from increasing local civic engagement and marketing fundamentals for businesses to ideas for the creative economy and a discussion on housing solutions, among many others. Forging Our Future was the theme of the day-long conference, which also gave those attending multiple opportunities to meet informally with one another, network in person, and catch up on what's been going on beyond their own backyards. Rob Riley, the president of Northern Forest Center, which works to build communities and economic and environmental disciplines to build the northern tier of New England, gave the opening keynote address.
We have different levels of financial resources and disparities among, whether it be Southern Vermont, Northeast Kingdom, whether it be other rural places or Chittenden County, right? You have increasingly diverging politics, which makes this work even harder when you say, how do we come to the table together? A changing climate, globalizing economies, which has been going on forever. But what we're seeing now, these used to be really negatives, but how do we think about harnessing these challenges as positives for this region, for rural places? We have to be really fighting for volunteers in our fire departments, in our communities. We really need to be making sure that we're looking at getting kids into our schools. Birthing centers, maternity care in our healthcare institutions, right? When we lose those pillars for this notion of scale and what people want to be seeing, we're really going to be suddenly really trying to manage decline as opposed to channeling growth, which I think is a place we want to be.
The conference then broke into a range of smaller discussion groups around a variety of topics, led by various leaders who shared their perspectives and prompted feedback from attendees.
Tried to have minority-owned businesses on our board of 25%. Yep. That died on the vine, both of them.
Yeah.
So like they didn't say no, yeah. They didn't say yes. We argued for 5 hours and went back and forth, and then all of a sudden it kind of went away, and I think part of that was the pandemic. But it is saying some of that back-end stuff, it's not just saying we need more young people or we need greater diversity. It's taking bold and courageous things that say we may fall flat on our face, we may not reach 25% next year, and that's okay, but we need to start to put in some of the systems and the guardrails that say we're holding ourselves accountable for this, not just saying it whispery in the air, but we're actually going to take bold moves on it. So I agree, Oxen.
Probably 3 times your age, and I know how to do a lot of that stuff.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Adam Grinold, the executive director of the Brattleboro Development Credit Corporation, which along with the Bennington County Regional Commission hosted the conference, gave us his takeaway on the summit, which has grown considerably since its start back in 2017.
I think as we come out of this summit, really focused on forging our future, a lot of the attendees can really take that, use that, those definitions that we talked about earlier about what is forging and how do you shape new circumstances, or how do you create new relationships, or actually, create a new situation. And so many of our businesses, our municipalities that are here, the state, all those folks working together here in the Southern Vermont Zone have really now, over 6 years of this effort, learned how to work together, learned how to leverage opportunities to do just that. So we have, a school district in Bennington County who has the same problems as a school district in Windham County. They come to this event, they talk about it, they realize they have the same problem. And so through that connection, they can work on solutions at a scale that they might not have realized existed. And those kind of things are happening between educators, between municipalities, between our hospitality businesses that are here. So we really see the energy in the room today focused on how do they come together, use the assets and the resources that the state and the federal government can provide, and leverage those for the greatest outcome.
The conference grew out of the Comprehensive Economic Development Strategy, or SEDS, plan, which aimed to boost the regional economy of Southern Vermont, which in turn grew out of the establishment of the Southern Vermont Economic Zone by the state legislature in 2015. The SEDS project led to the establishment of a series of vital projects, some of which were highlighted in a video presentation developed by GNET and shown at the conference. The conference also continued a tradition of recognizing and celebrating several emerging leaders from the area. According to the program guide, the award highlights outstanding Vermonters under 40 who are doing amazing work in their community. They bring passion, skill, and empathy into the workplace and beyond. We had a chance to speak with Ahmad Yasir, the digital sales and marketing specialist for Vermont News and Media, who was one of those recognized as an emerging leader.
Now I can put a face on a lot of emails that I've reached out to before. I mean, that's the beauty of Vermont, really. I mean, we're all so close, but also so distant, to the point where, like, I have seen a lot of people, a lot of community members, a lot of community partners that I've worked with in the past that I never really get to see in person. Like, whether they don't necessarily come to Bennington a lot, or I don't see them when I leave Bennington. And
Beth Wallace is the assistant director of the United Counseling Service, and she was named an emerging leader 2 years ago during the economic summit held in 2021.
I think this is a really exciting time for Bennington, for Southern Vermont. I think we've benefited over the last couple of years, you know, those silver linings that have come out of COVID, of having a lot of folks move to our area because people looked around and realized that Vermont really is the best place to be in or out of a pandemic. And so we've got so much new energy in Bennington in particular. We have a lot of new young people in Bennington. We have new breweries and cideries and trails, and we just have so much going on that I'm really looking forward to the next year.
The summit wrapped up with a series of afternoon breakout sessions, one of which was about housing and included Representative Seth Bongartz on one of the panels.
We have all of these issues, all the difficulties that we all know about of getting housing built. Everything from the cost of materials to the lack of people to do it. But one of the issues is municipal zoning. And so we really spent the summer really looking at and thinking carefully about municipal zoning, which in many cases, is held over, hasn't changed a lot for the last 50 years, where we still have large setbacks in downtowns.
And if you want to watch the full version of the video created by GNET for the summit, go to GNET's website, gnet-tv.org/seds-vital-projects. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. The gym at the Manchester Elementary Middle School was rocking on Tuesday morning, June 6th, for the return of Brave the Shave, which was last held in 2019, before the COVID pandemic forced a pause. A group of four, two students and two adults well known to all of the school community, took their places to have their hair cut, to show support for children afflicted with cancer, and to raise money for cancer research. The event is sponsored by the St. Baldrick's Foundation, which raises money to assist children who suffer from cancer. Events like Brave the Shave are held nationwide. The statistics on childhood cancer are striking. According to St. Baldrick's Foundation's website, more children are lost to cancer in the U.S. than by any other disease. In fact, more than many other childhood diseases combined. Before they turn 20, about one in every 263 children in the United States will have cancer. Worldwide, a child is diagnosed with cancer every 2 minutes. But progress has been made. In the 1950s, almost all kids diagnosed with cancer died. Because of research, today about 90% of kids with the most common type of cancer will live. But for many other types, progress has been limited, and there are still some kids for which there is little hope for a cure. This year, more than $7,000 was raised by the four Shavees at MEMS, and more than $82,000 has been raised all told since 2015, when the first Breathe the Shave event was held at MEMS. We talked with Anna Nicholson, a guidance counselor at MEMS and the organizer of the event, before it got started.
Well, this is a fundraiser for the St. Baldrick's Foundation, which raises money for childhood cancer research. It's actually the most underfunded government program. And so this is just a wonderful head shaving event where they can shave their heads in solidarity with children who have lost their hair during chemotherapy. And all of the money from St. Baldrick's goes for grants for childhood cancer research to find a cure.
And how long does it typically take for hair to grow back? Do we know?
Well, I've shaved my head and it's long like this. It takes a couple years, to get back to this. But it's a little sacrifice that makes a big difference with kids who are actually fighting this.
Michelle Jones is the owner of the Glam Boutique in Manchester, and she was the hair cutter.
It's kind of emotional, though, especially for some of the kids and the people with the background stories as well. And these kids, they get themselves prepared for it, or adults. And then when they actually get to the moment, you know, you can see that they're emotional. I feed off that, too. But this is almost my fourth year doing it. And yeah, I'll be here every year that they do it from here on out, for sure.
So is there a certain technique to it all?
No, there are rules to it, though. You can't have any attachment on it. So it's going to be as short as possible. But it is. It's kind of just going with it and cleaning all the hair off.
Before things got started, Anna Nicholson gave a quick introduction.
The reason why this it started here at MEMS is because I had the pleasure of working with kids with cancer for 7 years. And I will tell you that they have the healthiest attitude of any child or adult. And that's because their childhood and their health were taken away so early. So for my time with them, they've inspired me to fight for childhood cancer research. These kids are amazing. And so that's why we started this, and I am so proud of our MEMS community. I'll share the number of how much money we've raised actually over the years. It's really impressive. Over the course of 5 years, Manchester Elementary Middle School has raised over, get this, $82,000.
And then it was time to cut some hair. The four people who volunteered their hair for the worthy cause were Paula Madison, the former receptionist at MEMS who is now retired, Kevin Murphy, a paraeducator and member of the school's anchor program, and two students, Charlie Edwins and Sam Nicholson. Four more heroes joined the ranks of MEMS that Tuesday morning, but they won't be the last. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.